I'm going to describe a new platform. This is not so much going to be a talk about entertainment per se, although I think you should be able to draw your own conclusions about where this work leads. This is a product of the last year of thinking and research between myself and Angus Fraser, my graduate student who's sitting in the front row. This represents an interim report on our research at this point. So, a few weeks ago I was shooting the last episode of the season of The New Inventors, a show on ABC television. The grand final is on this evening, by the way. I invite you all to watch it. And they invited the panelists to come out, and as James was introducing the panelists to the studio audience, he said, "This is Mark Pesce, he's a futurist," and he put me on the spot. He said, "Mark, make a prediction." Okay, and I thought about it for a minute, and I turned to the audience, and I furrowed my brow and said, "In 5 years' time, you're going to be using your mobile telephones 10 times more than you do today." And the audience groaned. They just gasped. It wasn't a gasp of disbelief. It wasn't dismissal. It was wearied acceptance. They recognized the inevitability of the prediction, and they dreaded it. Now, why? Because telephony is actually a very joyous thing for us. Telephony has taken the ability of the human voice out of just the range of our ears and extended it across the planet so that I can talk to someone in California or New York or in London for basically no cost, basically all of the time. We enjoy talking on the phone. And yet, the thought of spending more time doing that fills us with some sort of existential dread. And it was that friction that set me en route to the talk that I'm giving today. Because the disconnect that we see between the joy of communication and the Proustian bed of our technologies deserves our full attention. We spend a lot of time developing new communication technologies, and we do it without considering how they fit the users. Now, Marshall McLuhan said that every technology shapes the users who use the medium. In other words, it cuts and fits them to the medium itself. So every communications technique, every telephone that's ever been invented, every interface, shapes the messages that can be sent through it. And it shapes and frames what the sender and receiver can transmit cognitively, emotionally, and socially. It's our assertion that the telephone as we know it today is largely a set of vestigial organs. It's poorly suited to its actual task, and that the resentment engendered by the device is the inevitable byproduct of a continuing series of unsatisfactory interactions with the device. So, when you have a conclusion like that, it casts doubt on the entire recent history of the mobile telephone. And that's been rife with invention, and yet it's never been quite successful because none of these designs have actually been driven by the mass of individuals who use the phone. We also assert that the essential design principles which must be embodied in the telephone can only be discerned. They cannot be invented. The telephone is not a style. It is not a fashion. It's something much closer to human language in that you must be immersed in it in order to have an understanding and comprehension of it. We assert the necessity of observation before action. We must watch how people communicate before we can understand what their communication needs are. It's only from this observation that we can draw any reasonable conclusions. Now, 15 years ago, this would have been a very simple affair because a telephone call was two parties talking over a single line. Basically, hadn't changed since we had tin cans on a string. But today, all human communication, and particularly electronic communication, is threaded, multi-participatory, multimodal, asynchronous, proximally indistinct, ubiquitous, continuous, and pervasive. Given this enormous change in the ground conditions of communication, it seems perfectly sensible that we should rethink the basic instrument of electronic communication. Now, as the most concrete and pervasive manifestation of cyberspace, the mobile telephone invariably establishes new patterns of cultural behavior. And if through observation we can learn the form of these new patterns, we could design a device that plays into those patterns and amplifies those patterns. Instead of the street finding its own use for things, we could have a comprehensive design science revolution. We could transform the mobile telephone into a cultural probe, an amplifier, and a filter. The question then is whether we as academics, engineers, scientists, researchers, media theorists, whether we secretly dread the call of the future, or whether we will approach this moment as an opportunity for play. In free play, the results are unimportant. The performance is all. Therefore, we need have no goal in our investigation beyond having a good time. Playing with mobile telephones is like playing with words, because the medium transmits words, and because the medium transmits words and leaves an indelible mark upon them. Since words shape the world, transforming the mobile telephone is inherently a revolutionary act. We therefore propose revolution. But revolution without revelation is slavery, so we must seek enlightenment in the wisdom of crowds. For the mobile telephone is the medium of the crowd in its modern incarnation, the swarm. So, studying the mobile telephone in situ is the only way to have any understanding of its actual role in human communication. We must draw what lessons we can from the observed behavior of swarms. Now, we take it as a given that nearly everyone living in the Western world enjoys the benefits of a globally pervasive, ubiquitous, continuous data network. The main access points into this network are desktop computers and laptops, at least that's the popular designation. There are, however, half again as many mobile handsets in the world as there are internet-connected computers. The vast majority of these handsets can easily make connections to the internet, but these devices are not thought of as internet-attached. That's the first of the telephone repairs that has to be performed. Upon connection to the internet, each individual passes through a series of evolutionary stages as the technology of pervasive instantaneous communication becomes ontologically embraced. What happens is it starts to form one component of the individual's reaction and understanding of being. These stages are replicated self-similarly across large numbers of users, up to and including the swarm. For this reason, the history of the internet and the history of the human use of the internet is reflected in patterns of individual use. The individual follows the history of the patterns established by the swarm. In other words, ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny. I have that backward. Phylogeny recapitulates ontogeny. So stage one is the age of discovery, where the user simply clicks into oblivion in an endless drum of media, never resting, never ceasing, but always moving on and on and on. This is the beginning of the age of the web surfer that we saw in 1994, 1995. The behavior here is analogous to a kid in a candy store or a yeast cell in a nutrient broth. Both of them will eat themselves sick. The user is excited and empowered and thinks only of quantity, not quality. Yet this constant feeding, the constant restlessness, does not satisfy. Once the user is convinced that this wealth won't simply vanish, a locus of reflective behavior forms. And stage two, the age of discrimination, begins. When there is enough and more, strategies shift from simple acquisition to meeting the needs of the moment in the most effective way. We started off with the NCSA list of all the sites on the internet, which became the Yahoo category-based list of all sites, which became Alta Vista's free text search, which became Google's PageRank. Each of these represented a refinement of the strategies that preceded it, and each of these were replaced by their predecessors because of the natural selection pressure imposed by all of the users who were trying to do all of the things in all of their ways. The natural selection pressure is itself scale invariant. You make decisions as a single user when you're picking which search engine to use, which are reflected inside the mind of the swarm as a whole. When an individual finds a better way to get what they want, when they want it, the technique is broadly adopted, and that tends to drive all of its competitive techniques into extinction. So although all of the techniques developed since 1993 are still there, except for the NCSA list of websites, natural selection pressure has favored Google PageRank with the best selection fitness for the current internet ecology. Google appears to understand this, and it subjects its own methodologies to constant mutation, constant tinkering. They're adjusting their own algorithmic DNA to fit the needs of the swarm. So, once the user masters the techniques of discrimination, stage three, the age of virtual communities, begins. The user spontaneously forms a network of networks of communication, social networks, that's what they're called in the current parlance, which sit above the pervasive any-to-any communication possibilities of the internet. In addition to the natural social relationships of proximity, kinship, and friendship, new social relationships which are bounded by common interest, communities, emerge. These virtual communities bear only accidental relationship to proximity. They only bear accidental relationship to kinship and to culture. They exist only because there is a medium that can support the constant reinforcement of those connections. Without cyberspace, there can be no virtual community. Within cyberspace, virtual communities are the rule. The unified swarm explores itself. It finds resonances within itself. These produce sub-swarms, and those communities then emerge. Again, this same process takes place within the individual as it does within the swarm. Once the individual learns how to tune the dial, the individual becomes aware of others who are tuning the dial to the same channel, and they then seeks communion with them. Stage four, representing the present day, is the age of swarming hyper-distribution of media. Every individual harnesses their own network to create their own media distribution network. We have, over the last 24 months, rapidly moved into a place and time where every individual has their own broadcast network. We hyper-distribute much of what comes our way. We forward email, links to websites, podcasts, video clips, flash animations, 3D games, etc., etc., etc. We spend an ever greater portion of our time forwarding, that is, publishing, relevant media into the relevant links in our social network. This, right now, is where we are, both as individuals and as a swarm. Each of us is building and becoming our own distribution network. Occasionally, we create the content in their networks, but far more often, even if we are full-time media producers, we pass content through our networks. Now that's the reason why 80 million people forwarded links to JibJab's This Land, countless millions have forwarded links to the video of the Chinese university students singing the Backstreet Boys song, and many, many millions of people have seen video of an exploding whale. Although these examples are exceptional because of the breadth of their distribution, the same processes are taking place in a scale-invariant fashion throughout the entirety of the swarm, sub-swarms, and in individual members. Now, to understand what's going on there, we need to ask ourselves why. Why do we forward media through our social networks? Why has this become the consuming task of the present era of the internet? One possible explanation can be drawn from the study of human social networks. These networks are thoroughly dynamic. They're subject to selection pressures because they have limits. Those limits are termed by something called the Dunbar number. The Dunbar number says that the number of first-degree connections in my social network, the number of people I can maintain close and immediate contact with, can never be greater than 150. It's not precisely known why this is, but as you can see in Figure 1, there's a direct correlation between the neocortex ratio of the primates, up to and including man, and the maximum group size that can be maintained within a troop or tribe or social network. Now, the great apes, such as chimpanzees and gorillas, can hold between 30 and 60 members in their social networks. We can hold about 150. And we can understand from this that the management of the social network is one of the highest cognitive functions that a human being can practice, because it is based literally in the newest parts of the brain. It is well known that individual humans or apes who are ostracized from their communities spontaneously age and die. Their endocrine systems rebel. They start destroying the body. Individuals who fail to establish strong social networks fail to thrive, and thus fail to pass their genes and memes off to their offspring. The inverse is also believed to be true. Individuals with strong social networks tend to live longer, healthier lives. The development of dense social networks may be our evolutionary response to this essential feature of neuroendocrinology, a response with both biological and mimetic components. We establish and maintain social networks through strategies of interaction. In the great apes, this interaction is grooming and food sharing. In human beings, it's information sharing. The careful balance which weights all of the relative values of the nodes in human social networks are determined by the interactions between ourselves and our first-degree nodes. Obviously, proximity is a strong determinant of weighting in that network. Individuals we see daily have a heavy weighting in our social networks, but for those nodes that are not proximal, individuals who exist ontologically in virtual space, the weighting is determined solely by the quality of the informational interactions. We thrive within social networks that have become far more fluid than ever before. They're no longer bounded by physical proximity, where informational exchange is the sole arbiter of rank. And this means that the selection pressure to maintain position within a social network is stronger than at any time before. We are all working harder than ever to maintain our position within partially virtualized social networks. Since information transactions are one way we can establish and maintain our rank within a social network, we are placing an increasing emphasis on the three F's: finding, filtering, and forwarding. Each information transaction produces, as a result, some social currency. While social currency is not transferable between social networks, within a social network it is the determinant of one's social rank. Thus we see the emergence of tastemakers within a given community who lead that community through their steady accumulation of social currency. Now that this has been recognized as a successful strategy, not only by individuals but also by commercial organizations, we are all rapidly adopting the technique. Self-similarly, the swarms and subswarms are also adopting it. This explains the recent and explosive emergence of technologies like Delicious, which accelerate and hyper-distribute the accumulation of social currency. We've become a species of cool hunters, and the hunters that can bag the biggest, most impressive game are given precedence within the community. This is the why behind the what. Now, we're just at the beginning of the era of digital social networks. The efforts thus far have been interesting experiments, but they have universally failed to realize the enormous potential to accelerate the accumulation of social capital within social networks. The earliest digital social networks, you know them, Friendster, Orkut, MySpace, the Facebook, they manage to embody the idea of the 6 degrees of separation, and they produce a digital representation of a social network which is composed both of proximal and virtual members. But they have neither the capacity nor the design intent to embody the dynamic nature of human social networks, which vary from moment to moment and task to task. Existing digital social networks treat the human being as a static entity, which is a category error of the first order. A human social network is a living thing, and it has to be treated as such. This is a mistake so fundamental. Let me illustrate with another example. Would Google's PageRank remain relevant if Google didn't continuously search and digest the web? PageRank would grow stale, and it would become useless in very short order. In this sense, digital social networks are like sharks. They must eat if they are always to survive. So digital social networks, in order to be useful, must be active, and they must be extraordinarily well-fed. Existing digital social networks are designed to be passive. They require constant human intervention to reflect the dynamically evolving relationship between the nodes within the network. This is neither feasible nor reasonable. we would need to spend more time maintaining the digital social network than we do maintaining our real-world social network. That's a basic failure in design. A digital social network needs to draw from our data shadows constantly, like a digital vampire, building its soul out of our actions in cyberspace. With that, we've reached the forward frontier of the evolution of networked humanity, both as swarm and individual. This paper has outlined a problem in precise terms. What remains now is to describe a solution. Collectively, we have created a whole host of techniques which we use to manage our social networks, whether they're mailing lists or address books, so on. They help, but we haven't put any computational intelligence behind these techniques. Furthermore, these informal techniques, which have been developed sort of in an ad hoc basis, are poorly fit to the tasks, and they're losing their utility as the information pressure on our social networks increases and increases and increases. Fortunately, that pressure drives evolution. It drives both the need and the capability to change, to mutate, if you will, in search of solutions which will be better suited to the selection pressures of social networks. So now that we have an in-situ understanding of the needs of the swarm, let's move on and turn our attentions to the telephone. Now, before we can begin any discussion of the repair of the telephone, and in truth, it is not the telephone that needs repair, but rather that we who design them must repair our thinking, it is necessary to prick consciousness with a few probes, interventions in the form of questions, which will help illuminate the enormous weight of subconscious and unrecognized prejudice which accompany the modern mobile telephone. These questions outline the telephone's disconnects, where logic and reason fail, and where prejudice has been embodied. So question one, why does the mobile have a keypad? Automatic dialing technology is about 80 years old. Before that, calls were switched by an operator on a switchboard. Mechanical automation got rid of that. And then, of course, in the 50s and 60s, you got DTMF dialing, touch tone dialing, and we got the touch tone keypad. That's what we consider the natural interface to the telephone, even though that interface isn't quite as old as I am. In the years before the microprocessor revolution, when AT&T and its ilk stamped out millions and millions and millions of DTMF touchtone telephones, users had to peck the number into the telephone every time they raised the handset. No one thought twice about it. How often do you tap a number into your mobile phone? I've done informal polling. About once a week is what I've been hearing. All right. So if we're using the keypad on our mobile phone once a week, why is half of the interface of a mobile telephone the keypad? Oh, come on. You know why. What do you use that interface for? Text messaging. Text messaging is the killer app for the mobile telephone, and the keypad is the interface to that service. Yet, text messaging via keypad is so slow and so fraught, even with predictive text, that it's amazing we bother to do it at all. It's a clear indication that the drive, the desire to send text messages is so strong that we're willing to put up with an offensive interface in order to do it. Nevertheless, every time we do it, we have a little bit of resentment at that interface, and that resentment persists, and every time we send a text message, it sort of irritates that wound a bit. And that's one of the reasons why that audience at the New Inventors gave up that groan. Now, why do we use a keypad for SMS? Because that's the interface we've got. And why is that the interface we've got? Because it's a telephone, and a telephone has to have a keypad. It's the one absolutely uniform feature on a telephone. People need to dial numbers, only no one dials numbers anymore. They're all in our address books. I don't even remember numbers anymore. I can remember my mobile number, and I can remember my office number. That's it. Oh, and I can remember the voicemail number. But that's it. Everything else is managed inside my mobile phone, which is as it should be. And as we transition to a VoIP world, the concept of the phone number becomes entirely meaningless and gets replaced by a SIP URL. At that point, we're never going to type numbers into our telephones again. The interface to text messaging, the keypad, shapes all communication through the device. And there's two examples contrasting about reactions to that interface. A few weeks ago, I learned how to send text messages through my Macintosh into my phone and up into the network. And all of a sudden, I had my full keypad, and I was a happy camper. I could do all sorts of things. I'd send people messages, and they'd be rich text messages, all smiles and everything. But they'd be there. And as a non-native user of text messaging, I found an enormous relief and an enormous release in having the full capabilities of the keyboard interface, which I'm highly used to, available for me. On the other hand, the younger generation has gone into the opposite direction, and they've adapted communication forms which are bounded by this interface, and they've created a linguistic pidgin which is very rich and which reads like shorthand. So the informational pressure behind text messaging has been so strong that we've seen the emergence of new SMS-based languages. That same pressure is pushing the mobile telephone through a series of different interfaces. You have, for example, a BlackBerry, which says, oh, okay, we'll give you a full interface, but you're going to get arthritis in your thumbs by using it. Others favor modalities where you can talk to the device. The keypad itself, however, is a vestigial organ. It will wither away and then disappear entirely, and it will be resurrected as a ghost, as a virtualized on-screen keypad for those rare occasions when you actually need to put a number in your phone. Question two, to how many networks is the mobile telephone connected? The telephone is essentially a network terminal. It provides services to the users by making, maintaining, and destroying connections to the network. In Australia, we readily acknowledge that our mobile telephones are connected to two networks, GSM, which handles lightly digitized analog traffic, and GPRS, which is a packet-switched data-only network with full TCP/IP capabilities. As third-generation 3G phones become pervasive, the analog-only network is going to vanish, and we will have an all-digital, high-speed, pervasive packet-switched TCP/IP network connection coming into the phone all the time. These are the networks we connect with our mobile phones, but these are not all. The average model telephone for sale today, say anything that costs over $100, actually presents at least four network interfaces. In addition to the standard GSM GPRS interfaces, the mobile telephone is also equipped with an IRDA interface, Infrared Data Association. IRDA is a very short range, line of sight, point to point, not particularly high speed. Historically, it's been used to send things like business cards back and forth between phones. And it's not really suitable for file transfers of any size. So it's not really been widely used, but it's very inexpensive to implement, and so it does show up on most mobile phones. The fourth network interface, and by far the more interesting one, is Bluetooth. Bluetooth is a low-power wireless networking technology which provides a sphere of coverage of about 10 meters in radius around the Bluetooth device. Bluetooth's been around since about the late 1990s. It was launched with great fanfare. A bunch of devices were introduced which promptly did not interoperate. The market collapsed. The bugs are fixed. And now, at this point, 5 million Bluetooth devices are manufactured every week. That includes mobile phones, laptops, PDAs, wireless headsets, and so on. Now, at this point, Bluetooth is not used for very much. That's very interesting. It's a more reliable replacement for IRDA, because it doesn't rely on line of sight, but rather on proximity. It's used to keep devices synchronized, so you can get your calendar onto your phone and you can get your pictures off your phone. But it's capable of very much more than that. Its link layer, that is layer 3 in the protocol stack, is capable of managing what are called piconets of 8 devices, one master and 7 slaves. And these devices can overlap in physical and logical space, so that the same device can be a slave in one network and master of another. This means that when Bluetooth devices are brought together in arbitrary configurations, they can immediately form complex network topologies. Furthermore, the network topology need not be entirely local, because one Bluetooth device could act as a proxy and pass data from the PicoNet onto the internet and back again. We haven't seen anything like this show up in our mobile phones. Although the mobile phones we carry around with us have the advantage of some of the best wireless networking technology on the planet, we're still using Bluetooth basically to push discrete blocks of data around. We are not treating these devices as nodes within a packet-switched network. Why? because we haven't recognized the power of this highly versatile network interface. We have seen the mobile telephone purely as a terminal on GSM, GPRS networks, but it's actually a terminal on at least four different networks. And now, as mobile telephones get 802.11 Wi-Fi connections, they will present five network interfaces. Yet we continue to insist and believe that these other interfaces simply do not exist. Question three, what's the mobile so busy doing? Now, the modern mobile telephone, this is mine, this is a brand new K750i, so it's a top-of-the-line Sony Ericsson phone. It's an impressively powerful device. It has a gigabyte of non-volatile memory. It's got an operating system, Symbian OS. It's got a Java virtual machine running J2ME, a host of customized CES for audio processing, for wireless processing, for Bluetooth. It's even got chips inside of it that will manage the vector map that accelerate the 3D rendering that can take place on the display so I can play games. But I have a question for you. It's going to be slightly offensive in this room. Why would I want to play games on my mobile phone? And I don't mean to question the validity of mobile entertainment, because that's a nice big industry. It makes billions of dollars a year. And it's all about making the things so that people can use the mobile to fill the otherwise empty moments in their lives. And I am not questioning the desire of humans to be entertained every single moment of the day, although maybe I should. Rather, I'm asking if this is an appropriate use of the mobile telephone. The mobile telephone, like our laptop and our desktop computers, suffers from consistent underutilization. We rarely keep it busy. Even when it is engaged in managing a voice phone call, it's only using a very small portion of its processing capabilities. The mobile telephone represents a computational resource which is almost entirely underutilized. Hence, the phone is free for games and other forms of entertainment. But why is the phone so underutilized? Again, this is a vestigial quality of analog fixed-line telephony. Fixed-line telephones did nothing until the network sent a call to the telephone or a user picked up the phone and dialed. In other words, the duty cycle was entirely controlled by the users in the network. That basic assumption drives the design of mobile telephones today. We're still thinking of them as devices that have to be activated, that are not agents in their own right. Why should this be? There's no essential purpose served in such passivity. Far from it. But the mobile telephone has been cursed by its ancestry. And this is the most important thing we must learn if we are to repair the telephone. The mobile telephone is only a passive device because we have designed it to be so. We believe that it is a necessary precondition for telephone repair that we treat the mobile telephone as an entirely active device, a network terminal which has been designed from its outset to facilitate management of and communication with the social network of its owner user. The mobile telephone is already the de facto device for digital social network management. Voice calls and text messages are arguably the most significant components of the electronic communication within our social networks. But because they are ephemeral, because synchronous voice communication and asynchronous text messages aren't tracked by anything, because they aren't captured except on your phone bill, we underestimate their importance. If we transform the mobile telephone into an active device and design it to be conscious of the communication which is happening through it and around it, we have a device that can develop a data shadow from which we can build emergent models of our social network. The mobile telephone is the only device which is well suited to this task. It is the only device capable of recording our lives as they happen. The mobile telephone, therefore, should be fully realized as an active device which takes note of our digital social interactions, using this information to assist us in improving the quality of those interactions. This is the core principle that we recommend be put into practice. Without this step forward, nothing else is possible. And the mobile telephone will remain an overpowered, underutilized twin of its mechanical analog ancestor. Because of the growing importance of ad hoc digital social networks, there is a growing pressure to consistently improve and reinforce all of the connections in our social networks. Should we succeed in transforming the mobile telephone into an instrumentality of our social networks, that transformation will release this pressure, and it will drive the mobile telephone into a fantastic array of mutations and forms. It will be a Cambrian explosion of communication brought into being when we connect our need to our capability. The impact of such a transformation would be immediate and profound. When users stop fighting the interface and find instead that the interface enables social network management, those users will enter into a new ontological accommodation with the device. They will, in short, find the mobile entirely indispensable, even more so than today. It will not be thought of as a device for voice communication or even a terminal for text messaging. It will be the portal into the user's social network, the physical, proximal, and ubiquitous connection into the sphere of humanity. There is precedent for such a rapid transformation in the behavior of a device. The 24 months from 1994 to 1996, which saw the web browser growing from its origins as a hacker curiosity to the indispensable tool of the information age. Our analysis of the requirements for this transformation in mobile telephony from passive to active modes indicates that the technological infrastructure for this revolution is already in place. This is a revolution in software, not in hardware. A revolution in usability, not in deployment. The handsets and networks are already fully ubiquitous. We only need to learn how to design the software to fit the needs of the network's users. To do that, we must experiment and play and listen to the users. Could you get me some water? Thank you. Theory is good, observation is better. I've been observing the growth of the internet since I was first on it in 1988. The growth of user communities, the growth of swarms. I've done some swarm management, although it was called community management back 10 years ago. Angus Fraser, a graduate student, has deep experience in the issues of mobility and usability. When we put the two of those together, we've got one of those moments of concrescence. We got novelty out of the concatenation of his skills and my own. And that has led us from theory, which is what you've gotten so far, into practice. We are presently designing technological probes. We're testing the theses that we've already laid out in this paper in order to concretize our own understanding. Now, Angus Fraser is the former director of user experience at Hutchinson Telecoms Australia, and he has a strong understanding of the desires and frustrations of mobile network telephone users. The real-world insights that he has guided us into designs which require a minimum of user intervention. In other words, we have done our best in what we're about to show you to design systems that just work without a lot of care and feeding. We figure that that is absolutely essential to any design. The first example of this philosophy, which was created by Angus over the last few months, is something called Image Show. It's a Java J2ME application which fetches images from a photo sharing site, right now it's Flickr, allowing the mobile to dip into the Flickr stream and simply pull pictures out one after another after another. You can also provide tags or usernames and pull images out of a specific Flickr stream or based on a specific series of tags. And if you come and speak to either Angus or I afterward, we both have it on our phones, we'd be delighted to show you how it works. It's a very simple idea, something that doesn't require a lot of user intervention, but simply allows people to experience a flow of social network information. Thank you. What follows now are three speculative use cases, shown principally from the user's point of view, and drawn from the themes thus far outlined in this paper. So if we start from the basic proposition that the mobile telephone ought to do everything within its power to be intensely aware of its environment, the first use case involves the emergent user experience of a mobile telephone programmed for active listening. In this case, the mobile telephone maintains simultaneous connections across all available network connections, using these as probes into the proximal and virtual environments. GSM GPRS provides connectivity to the global network, while Bluetooth and to a lesser extent IRDA provide a probe into the proximal environment. Now one of us, myself, has already constructed a small Java J2ME application which turns the mobile telephone into an active listening device. The application constantly scans the blue sphere, which is what I've termed the 10-meter radius around a Bluetooth device, keeping a record of all the devices it sees, and then reporting these via GPRS to a server. The server then puts these results into a database where we can do all sorts of fancy analysis on them. Our supposition when we created this little tool was that it should be possible to create a heuristic model of task modality, home, office, transit, whatever it would be, based on the information gathered by the active listening to the blue sphere. And here's figure two. This is from last Thursday. This shows my trip from Surrey Hills to North Ryde on City Rail. Over a period of 75 minutes, we start out quite stably at home. There's a couple of well-known Bluetooth devices in my home. Walk out on the street, walk out to a crowded platform at Central Station, and I get a bit of a data spike. My train comes, I get on the train, numbers sort of drop off. I probably pass through a couple of stations where there are Bluetooth devices on the platform, so I get a couple of spikes. I arrive at Epping Station, get a smaller spike that drops off again, get on the bus, get off the bus, and walk into my office. And yes, we've got a lot of Bluetooth devices in the office because we use Macintoshes and other fun things, and it levels off again. That heuristic pattern is repeatable day after day after day after day. That means that it requires minimal machine interference to translate a scan of the blue sphere into an assessment of task modality. Now, it needs to be noted that the act of listening to the blue sphere returns more than just the number of devices around. It returns the unique address of those devices and the names of those devices. And since the addresses are unique, they're very similar to Ethernet MAC addresses, if I know that there's a Bluetooth device which is at a fixed point, all I have to know is that I can see that device to know within 10 meters exactly where I am. So I can tell when I'm at home because I'll see one specific device. I can tell when I'm in the office, I'll see another one. It's a trivial operation to convert a Bluetooth address into a location in that sense. And then it's a trivial operation for the network to send that information back to my mobile and to alter the activity on my mobile based on the task modality that has been determined that my mobile needs to express. So once the server can generate information about task modality, it can treat the mobile network as a network terminal, and it can reconfigure the device to present information that's relevant to the task. So that means that my mobile telephone in the office can inform me about upcoming meetings and the things I need to know in the office. When I'm going home at night, it could warn me about rail delays and changing weather conditions. And it means that at home, it could remind me to turn on the television and watch a program recommended to me by a friend. None of this is difficult, but it is all quite useful, and it's all something that the telephone could be doing other than just sitting there like a stupid brick. And all of this requires a minimum of user interaction. The more interesting phenomenon comes from a detailed long-term analysis of blue sphere over a period of days to weeks. That analysis will show that certain devices come into blue sphere proximity regularly. And those occasions of proximity then become the foundation for an emergent social network. Rather than laboriously having to build the elements by hand on a website, the mobile telephone can simply listen to who's coming into proximity and under what context are they coming into proximity. And they'll understand then whether someone's in my social network because of work or because they're my friend or because I go shopping with them and so on and so on. This network will not necessarily be complete, but it will be substantial and it requires no user intervention and it is kept entirely dynamic. So that in itself is a very powerful capability. But active listening has to extend beyond the network interfaces available in the mobile telephone to the real-world interfaces available on the device. Most modern mobile telephones can make audio recordings. Very easy thing for them to do. If this recording capability were turned on all the time and simply saved to the device all the time, it should be possible, when you pair that with the user's emergent social network, to offer the user an opportunity to keep a full audio record of their day-to-day life. The mobile telephone would simply record the audio constantly. An entire day's recording is only 80 megabytes. It's a very small amount of data. And then at evening, it would simply synchronize that with the server. And then the server could simply show that data to the user. Think of something that looks a little bit like iCal, where you have this continuous audio recording, but it's annotated by who you were in contact with when. So if I, say, had a conversation with Angus in the middle of the afternoon, I'd be able to find that conversation because he and I were in proximity, click, and then hear that conversation played back. Now, it has to be noted that such features are as invaluable as they are dangerous. There are a host of privacy issues which are strewn through these examples. We are not unaware of them. But they have to be regarded as basic elements to be incorporated into the design of the system. Privacy rights management is important because we want to be able to share a lot of this information, but we want to be able to share it with a lot of granularity. Our basic belief is that users control the rights to their own data shadow and that they share this data with others at their peril. Example 2. Feeding a hungry social network with active interventions. Once the system has grown a model of the user's social network, it can then begin to feed that model as much information as can be gathered through active listening, and it will augment that through active interventions. In an active intervention, the mobile telephone will interrupt the user in meaningful ways designed to improve the quality of the user's social network. So in this use case, we'll consider a Thanksgiving dinner that I'm planning with friends for next weekend. One of those friends, James, will pop into a pub down the street, and James and I have agreed to share information on proximity. So when he's in the pub down the street, I know about it. My mobile knows about it. So I give him a call, which is noted by both of our mobiles because they're actively listening to our communication. And then I pop down to the pub. That's also noted because the devices come into proximity. And when our mobiles come into proximity, I get a little message, a little alert popping up on my phone, which is reminding me to ask James about the details of Thanksgiving dinner. And I do that, and there's no need for me to take any notes about this because this entire conversation is being recorded and I'll be able to play it back later, get all of my information. So after a few beers, James and I decide we're going to go see a film, but what should we go see? What's playing? Well, the task modality of the mobile has been changed to a social setting because it probably knows that I'm at the pub, it knows that I'm with James, it's late at night, I'm having some beers. So it's already there popping up with events, social things that I may want to be doing. And I can see that Wolf Creek has gotten a rave review from my friend Nicola, so James and I decided to go down to the Dendy in Newtown, walk in, buy a few tickets. Now the Dendy has a few Macintoshes installed with Bluetooth, and my phone notes this fact. So we go into the theater, and about 2 hours after I pop out of the theater, I get another intervention from my phone. It wants me to rate the film that I've seen, and that rating will be contributed to a shared list of ratings which are available to my social network. In addition, if I want to provide a review of the film, all I need to do is just talk into the phone, and the server will then save that review and share that within my social network. Now, many of my social interactions are observed by my mobile phone. And all of these are recorded, they're mapped, they're analyzed. But not all of my social interactions can be observed by the phone. Many of them take place with the laptop computer. My mobile telephone is with me wherever I go, but it can't actively listen to my computer. My computer, therefore, needs to shoulder some of this informational burden. I need to have an email client which notes who I receive email from and who I sent it to. It needs to add that information to the data shadow. Same thing with instant messaging, the same thing with the history in my web browser. There's a pattern here. We generate enormous data shadows. They're not just the ones related to our financial progress through the world, but they relate to our social and informational presence in the world. That information may be stored locally in whatever devices you're using, but it is not collated, it is not collected, it is not analyzed. In other words, we're depriving our data shadows of a consistent stream of information that they need and that we generate all the time that we communicate. For this reason, it's our recommendation that software designers, as a rule, implement audit trails of user activity, which can then be fed into digital dynamic social networks. It's relatively easy to do this within Gmail, which remembers every transaction that goes through it. It'd be relatively easy to create an extension for Firefox to do much the same thing. There are simple changes that would require no user intervention, but they would provide the data shadow with an ever better model of the user's activities. That information should never be discarded. It's far too valuable, and yet we are all throwing it away all the time. The value of an individual's data shadow has not been overlooked by commercial interests. Walmart, the largest retailer in the world, builds extensive data shadows on all of their customers, studying their buying patterns, constantly adjusting their store inventories to meet the needs of their customers. That's the basic premise that has driven the adoption of consumer loyalties programs, the biggest one of which in Australia is the Coles Myer Flybuys card. How many of you have Flybuys cards? Exactly. That's actually a low number. I'm surprised. Coles Myer offers incentives to Flybuys folks in return for the fact that they're going to build a data shadow on you. This information is essential to their purchasing plans. It allows Coles Myer to target individual consumers with offers that they're likely to accept. In other words, Coles Myer has a database which is drawn from your interactions with Coles Myer, and it's of great benefit to them. They guard that data tightly. They do not share it, even with the customers who create it. But there are very good reasons to share that data with customers. In our final use case, I'm popping into the Kohl's up at the Surrey Hill Marketplace shopping for Thanksgiving dinner. My mobile telephone knows I've entered the Kohl's because Kohl's has set up a small Bluetooth transmitter which identifies the store. Immediately, the task modality of my telephone changes and it displays my shopping list. Behind the scenes, the server, which is managing my own social network, is having a detailed and lengthy discussion with Coles Myer's own substantial computing facility. The server knows what I'm shopping for, and it negotiates with Coles Myer to get the lowest prices for each item on my shopping list. All of these sale prices are tied to my Flybuys card, so when I pass through checkout, the sale prices are applied. These prices are for my own eyes only, and really, I am not aware of them. What I do see, what pops up because it's important, is an offer for $5 off on a fine Thanksgiving turkey. That's important enough to get bounced up. It's the only thing that I'm aware of, even though this entire layer of transactions has taken place underneath the surface, between my own server and Coles Myer. Now, furthermore, when I pass through checkout, Coles Myer will do me the favor of informing my server of what I bought, what it all cost, and so on, so my server can now manage my own shopping list without my intervention. It also means that I can track my purchases and I can track my expenses without having to laboriously enter any data. All of this is easy enough to implement. If there's one thing that we learned during the dot-com boom and bust, it was how to make databases talk to each other. We have XML and other standards and roll-your-own protocols. There's programming involved here, but there's nothing extraordinary about it. User setup and user intervention are both minimal. As long as all parties can agree on how to communicate, it just works. But why would Coles Myer offer this service to their customers? The answer is obvious. Loyalty. Any store which could make my shopping experience as personalized and seamless as this is more likely to hold me as a customer. They get a better sense of their clientele as well, because Coles Myer not only finds out what people have shopped for, but it also finds out what they're looking for, and it can build models of consumer behavior. That'll help them tailor their store inventories. A commercial enterprise is as much a node within a social network as any individual. Strong and constantly reinforced informational relationships between those nodes will tend to improve their real-world relationships. It's no longer sufficient to consider electronic communication as a two-way affair. Electronic communication in the 21st century involves swarms of individuals engaged in commonly allied or loosely coupled or common tasks. The translation of human social networks into dynamic digital entities, which are fed constantly with devices which actively listen and actively intervene, create the necessary preconditions for a fifth stage in internet use, an era where our data shadows stand alongside our physical selves, working to maintain and improve the effectiveness, our effectiveness, across the breadth of our social networks. So, the present work draws on a lot of other work in ubiquitous computing and a beautiful paper by Stephen Blythe called My Social Fabric. It's in the references to this paper. I advise you to look it up. But what we're here to say, beyond drawing up use cases and rationales and philosophical ground that will help us design, is that the infrastructure for this transformation is already in place. This is a software problem, which means that in all likelihood it will be solved quickly. So we invite you to do your own research, play with these devices, learn from the users, and invent platforms for our human future. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark, for a fascinating talk. And I think you have convinced me that it's time that I get a high-end mobile phone, and so I don't get left out of this revolution.